I enjoyed meeting them. They're charming.
That's one way of putting it.
They remain a while at the table, talking, the sound of the rain echoing quietly in the enclosed space behind the house. The candles shrink to stubs, and specks of wax drip onto the table. Silas, who has been softly pacing on the floor, comes and presses his head against Goggle's leg, looking up at him, wagging his tail. Goggle bends over, pats him tentatively.
"You've never had a dog, have you?" Maxine says, observing him.
"No." "Didn't you ever want one?"
"When I was a kid. But my parents never wanted the responsibility. Plus, we had to go to India every couple of years."
He realizes it's the first time he's mentioned his parents to her, his past. He wonders if perhaps she'll ask him more about these things. Instead, she says, "Silas likes you. He's very picky." He looks at her, watching as she undoes her hair, letting it hang loose for a moment over her shoulders before wrapping it thoughtlessly around her hand. She looks back at him, smiling. Once again, he is aware of her nakedness beneath the cardigan.
"I should go," he says. But he is glad that she accepts his offer to help her clean up before leaving. They loiter over the task, loading the dishwasher, wiping down the table in the butcher block island, washing and drying the pots and pans. They agree to go to the film forum on Sunday afternoon to see the Antonioni double feature that Lydia and Gerald have recently been to and recommended over dinner.
"I'll walk you to the subway," Maxine says when they are finished, putting a leash around Silas. "He needs to go out." They go up to the parlor level, put on their coats. He hears the sound of a television faintly through the ceiling. He pauses at the foot of the stairs. "I forgot to thank your parents," he says.
"For what?"
"For having me over. For dinner." She links elbows with him.
"You can thank them next time."
Random House Audio presents The Namesake by Jhumpa Lahiri. Read for you by Sarita Chowdhury.
From the very beginning, he feels effortlessly incorporated into their lives. It is a different brand of hospitality from what he is used to. For though the Ratliffs are generous, they are people who do not go out of their way to accommodate others, assured, in his case correctly, that their life will appeal to him. Gerald and Lydia, busy with their own engagements, keep out of the way. Goggle and Maxine come and go as they please, from movies and dinners out. He goes shopping with her on Madison Avenue at stores they must be buzzed into, for cashmere cardigans and outrageously expensive English colognes that Maxine buys without deliberation or guilt. They go to darkened, humble-looking restaurants downtown, where the tables are tiny, the bills huge. Almost without fail, they wind up back at her parents' place. There's always some delicious cheese or pâté to snack on, always some good wine to drink. It is in her claw-footed tub that they soak together, glasses of wine or single malt scotch on the floor. At night he sleeps with her in the room she grew up in, on a soft, sagging mattress, holding her body, as warm as a furnace, through the night, making love to her in a room just above the one in which Gerald and Lydia lie. On nights he has to stay late at work, he simply comes over. Maxine keeps dinner waiting for him, and then they go upstairs to bed. Gerald and Lydia think nothing in the mornings when he and Maxine join them downstairs in the kitchen, their hair uncombed, seeking bowls of café au lait and toasted slices of French bread and jam. The first morning he'd slept over, he'd been mortified to face them, showering beforehand, putting on his wrinkled shirt and trousers from the day before. But they'd merely smiled, still in their bathrobes, and offered him warm, sticky buns from their favorite neighborhood bakery and sections of the paper. Quickly, simultaneously, he falls in love with Maxine, the house, and Gerald and Lydia's manner of living, for to know her and love her is to know and love all of these things. He loves the mess that surrounds Maxine, her hundreds of things always covering her floor and her bedside table, her habit, when they are alone on the fifth floor, of not shutting the door when she goes to the bathroom, her unkempt ways, a challenge to his increasingly minimalist taste, charm him. He learns to love the food she and her parents eat, the polenta and risotto, the bouillabaisse and ossobuco, the meat baked in parchment paper. He comes to expect the weight of their flatware in his hands, and to keep the cloth napkin, still partially folded,
on his lap. He learns that one does not grate Parmesan cheese over pasta dishes containing seafood. He learns not to put wooden spoons in the dishwasher, as he had mistakenly done one evening when he was helping to clean up. The nights he spends there, he learns to wake up earlier than he is used to the sound of Silas barking downstairs, wanting to be taken for his morning walk. He learns to anticipate every evening the sound of a cork emerging from a fresh bottle of wine. Maxine is open about her past, showing him photographs of her ex-boyfriends in the pages of a marble-papered album, speaking of those relationships without embarrassment or regret. She has the gift of accepting her life. As he comes to know her, he realizes that she has never wished she were anyone other than herself, raised in any other place, in any other way. This, in his opinion, is the biggest difference between them, a thing far more foreign to him than the beautiful house she'd grown up in, her education at private schools. In addition, he's continually amazed by how much Maxine emulates her parents, how much she respects their tastes and their ways. At the dinner table, she argues with them about books and paintings and people they know in common, the way one might argue with a friend. There's none of the exasperation he feels with his own parents, no sense of obligation. Unlike his parents, they pressure her to do nothing, and yet she lives faithfully, happily at their side. She is surprised to hear certain things about his life, that all his parents' friends are Bengali, that they had had an arranged marriage, that his mother cooks Indian food every day, that she wears saris and a bindi. "Really?" she says, not fully believing him. "But you're so different. I would never have thought that." He doesn't feel insulted, but he is aware that a line has been drawn all the same. To him, the terms of his parents' marriage are something at once unthinkable and unremarkable. Nearly all their friends and relatives had been married in the same way. But their lives bear no resemblance to that of Gerald and Lydia. Expensive pieces of jewelry presented on Lydia's birthday, flowers brought home for no reason at all, the two of them kissing openly, going for walks through the city or to dinner, just as Goggle and Maxine do. Seeing the two of them curled up on the sofa in the evenings, Gerald's head resting on Lydia's shoulder, Goggle is reminded that in all his life he has never witnessed a single moment of physical affection between his parents. Whatever love exists between them is an utterly private, uncelebrated thing. "That's so depressing," Maxine says when he confesses this fact to her, and though it upsets him to hear her reaction, he can't help but agree. One day Maxine asks him if his parents want him to marry an Indian girl. She poses the question out of curiosity, without hoping for a particular response. He feels angry at his parents then, wishing they could be otherwise, knowing in his heart what the answer is. "I don't know," he tells her. "I guess so. It doesn't matter what they want." She visits him infrequently. She and Goggle are never close to his neighborhood for any reason, and even the absolute privacy they would have had there is of no appeal. Still, some nights when her parents have a dinner party she has no interest in, or simply to be fair, she appears, quickly filling up the small space with her gardenia perfume, her coat, her big brown leather bag, her discarded clothes, and they make love on his futon as the traffic rumbles below. He is nervous to have her in his place, aware that he has put nothing up on his walls, that he has not bothered to buy lamps to replace the dismal glow of the ceiling light. "Oh, Nikhil, it's too awful," she eventually says on one of these occasions, barely 3 months after they've met. "I won't let you live here." When his mother had said more or less the same thing, the first time his parents had visited the apartment, he had argued with her, hotly defending the merits of his Spartan, solitary existence. But when Maxine says it, adding, "You should just stay with me," he is quietly thrilled. By then he knows enough about her to know she is not one to offer things if she doesn't mean them. Still, he demurs, "What would her parents think?" She shrugs. "My parents love you," she says matter-of-factly, definitively, just as she says everything else. And so he moves in with her, in a way, bringing a few bags of his clothes, nothing else. His futon and his table, his kettle and toaster, and television and the rest of his things remain on Amsterdam Avenue. His answering machine continues to record his messages. He continues to receive his mail there, in a nameless metal box. Within 6 months, He has the keys to the Ratliffs' house, a set of which Maxine presents to him on a silver Tiffany chain. Like her parents, he has come to call her Max. He drops off his shirts at the dry cleaner around the corner from her place. He keeps a toothbrush and razor on her cluttered pedestal sink. In the mornings, a few times a week, he gets up early and goes running before work with Gerald, along the Hudson, down to Battery Park City, and back. He volunteers to take Silas out for walks, holding the leash as the dog sniffs and pokes at trees, and he picks up Silas's warm shit with a plastic bag. He spends entire weekends holed up in the house, reading books from Gerald and Lydia's shelves, admiring the sunlight that filters through the enormous unadorned windows during the course of the day. He comes to prefer certain sofas and chairs to others. When he is not there, he can conjure the paintings and photographs arrayed on the walls. He has to make a point of going to his studio, of resetting the tape on his answering machine, paying his rent check and his bills. Often, on weekends, he helps to shop and prepare for Gerald and Lydia's dinner parties, peeling apples and deveining shrimp with Lydia, helping to shuck oysters, going down to the cellar with Gerald to bring up the extra chairs, the wine. He has fallen the tiniest bit in love with Lydia, and with the understated, unflustered way she entertains. He is always struck by these dinners, only a dozen or so guests sitting around the candlelit table, a carefully selected mix of painters, editors, academics, gallery owners, eating the meal course by course, talking intelligently until the evening's end. How different they are from his own parents' parties. Cheerfully unruly evenings to which they were never fewer than 30 people invited, small children in tow. Fish and meat served side by side, so many courses that people had to eat in shifts, the food still in the pans they were cooked in, crowding the table. They sat where they could, in the different rooms of the house, half the people having finished before the other half began. Unlike Gerald and Lydia, who preside at the center of their dinners, his parents behave more like caterers in their own home, solicitous and watchful, waiting until most of their guests' plates were stacked by the sink in order to finally help themselves. At times, as the laughter at Gerald and Lydia's table swells, and another bottle of wine is opened, and Goggle raises his glass to be filled yet again, he is conscious of the fact that his immersion in Maxine's family is a betrayal of his own. It isn't simply the fact his parents don't know about Maxine, that they have no idea how much time he spends with her and Gerald and Lydia. Instead, it is his knowledge that apart from their affluence, Gerald and Lydia are secure in a way his parents will never be. He cannot imagine his parents sitting at Lydia and Gerald's table, enjoying Lydia's cooking, appreciating Gerald's selection of wine. He cannot imagine them contributing to one of their dinner party conversations. And yet here he is, night after night, a welcome addition to the Ratliff's universe, doing just that. In June, Gerald and Lydia disappear to their lake house in New Hampshire. It is an unquestioned ritual, a yearly migration to the town where Gerald's parents live year-round. For a few days, a series of canvas tote bags accumulate in the hallway, cardboard boxes full of liquor, shopping bags full of food, cases of wine. Their departure reminds Goggle of his family's preparations for Calcutta every few years, when the living room would be crowded with suitcases that his parents packed and repacked, fitting in as many gifts as possible for their relatives. In spite of his parents' excitement, there was always a solemnity accompanying these preparations. Ashima and Ashok, at once apprehensive and eager, steeling themselves to find fewer faces at the airport in Calcutta, to confront the deaths of relatives since the last time they were there. No matter how many times they'd been to Calcutta, his father was always anxious about the job of transporting the four of them such a great distance. Goggle was aware of an obligation being fulfilled, that it was, above all else, a sense of duty that drew his parents back. But it is a call of pleasure that summons Gerald and Lydia to New Hampshire. They leave without fanfare, in the middle of the day, when Goggle and Maxine are both at work. In Gerald and Lydia's wake, certain things are missing. Silas, some of the cookbooks, the food processor, novels and CDs, the fax machine so that Gerald can keep in touch with his clients, the red Volvo station wagon they keep parked on the street. A note is left on the island in the kitchen. "We're off," Lydia has written, followed by X's and O's. Suddenly, Goggle and Maxine have the house in Chelsea to themselves. They stray to the lower stories, making love on countless pieces of furniture, on the floor, on the island in the kitchen, once even on the pearl-gray sheets of Gerald and Lydia's bed. On weekends, they wander naked from room to room, up and down the 5 flights of stairs. They eat in different places according to their moods, spreading an old cotton quilt on the floor, sometimes eating takeout on Gerald and Lydia's finest china, falling asleep at odd hours as the strong summer light of the lengthened days pours through the enormous windows onto their bodies. As the days grow warmer, they stop cooking complicated things. They live off sushi and salads and cold poached salmon. They switch from red wine to white. Now that it is just the two of them, it seems to him more than ever that they are living together. And yet for some reason, it is dependence, not adulthood, he feels. He feels free of expectation, of responsibility, in willing exile from his own life. He is responsible for nothing in the house. In spite of their absence, Gerald and Lydia continue to lord, however blindly, over their days. It is their books he reads, their music he listens to, their front door he unlocks when he gets back from work, their telephone messages he takes down. He learns that the house, for all its beauty, has certain faults in the summer months, so that it makes all the more sense that it is a place Gerald and Lydia annually avoid. It lacks air conditioning, something Gerald and Lydia have never bothered to install because they are never there when it's hot, and the enormous windows lack screens. As a result, the rooms are sweltering during the day, and at night, because it is necessary to leave the windows wide open, he is ambushed by mosquitoes that shriek in his ears and leave angry, lumpen welts between his toes, on his arms and thighs. He longs for a mosquito net to drape over Maxine's bed, remembers the filmy blue nylon boxes that he and Sonia would sleep inside of on their visits to Calcutta. The corners hooked onto the 4 posts of the bed, the edges tucked tightly beneath the mattress, creating a temporary, tiny, impenetrable room for the night. There are times when he cannot bear it, turning on the light and standing on the bed, looking for them, a rolled-up magazine or a slipper in his hand, as Maxine, unbothered and unbitten, begs him to get back to sleep. He sees them sometimes against the peach-colored paint on the wall, faint specks engorged with his blood, just inches below the ceiling, always too high up to kill. With work as an excuse, he does not go home to Massachusetts all summer. The firm is entering a competition, submitting designs for a new 5-star hotel to be built in Miami. At 11 at night, he is still there, along with most of the other designers on his team, all rushing to finish drawings and models by the month's end. When his phone rings, he hopes it's Maxine, calling to coax him into leaving the office. Instead, it's his mother. "Why are you calling me here so late?" he asks her, distracted, his eyes still focused on the computer screen. "Because you are not at your apartment," his mother says. "You are never at your apartment, Goggle. In the middle of the night I've called, and you are not there." "I am, Ma," he lies. "I need my sleep." I shut off the phone. "I cannot imagine why anyone would want to have a phone only to shut it off," his mother says. "So is there a reason you're calling me?" She asks him to visit the following weekend, the Saturday before his birthday. "I can't," he says. He tells her he has a deadline at work, but it's not true. That's the day that he and Maxine are leaving for New Hampshire, for 2 weeks. But his mother insists. His father is leaving for Ohio the following day. Doesn't Goggle want to go with them to the airport to see him off? He knows vaguely of his father's plans to spend 9 months at a small university somewhere outside Cleveland, that he and a colleague have received a grant funded by the colleague's university to direct research for a corporation there. His father had sent him a clipping about the grant printed in the campus newspaper, with a photograph of his father standing outside the engineering building. "Prestigious grant for Professor Ganguly," the caption read. At first, it was assumed that his parents would shut up the house or rent it out to students, and that his mother would go too. But then his mother had surprised them, pointing out that there would be nothing for her to do in Ohio for 9 months, that his father would be busy all day at the lab, and that she preferred to stay in Massachusetts,
even if it meant staying in the house alone.
"Why do I have to see him off?" Goggle asks his mother now.
He knows that for his parents, the act of travel is never regarded casually, that even the most ordinary of journeys is seen off and greeted at either end. And yet he continues, "Baba and I already live in different states. I'm practically as far from Ohio as I am from Boston."
"That's no way to think," his mother says. "Please, Goggle, you haven't been home since May."
"I have a job, Ma. I'm busy. Besides, Sonia's not coming."
"Sonia lives in California. You are so close."
"Listen, I can't come home that weekend," he says. The truth seeps out of him slowly. He knows it's his only defense at this point. "I'm going on a vacation. I've already made plans."
"Why do you wait to tell us these things at the last minute?" his mother asks.
"What sort of vacation? What plans?"
"I'm going to spend a couple of weeks in New Hampshire."
"Oh,"
his mother says. She sounds at once unimpressed and relieved.
"Why do you want to go there, of all places? What's the difference between New Hampshire and here?"
"I'm going with a girl I'm seeing," he tells her. "Her parents have a place there." Though she says nothing for a while, he knows what his mother is thinking, that he is willing to go on vacation with someone else's parents but not see his own.
"Where is this place exactly?"
"I don't know, somewhere in the mountains."
"What's her name?"
"Max."
"That's a boy's name."
He shakes his head. "No, Ma, it's Maxine." And so, on the way to New Hampshire, they stop off at Pemberton Road for lunch, which is what, in the end, he has agreed to. Maxine doesn't mind. It's on their way, after all, and she is curious by now to meet his parents. They drive up from New York in a rented car, the trunk packed with more supplies that Gerald and Lydia have asked them for on the back of a postcard. Wine, bags of a particular imported pasta, a large tin of olive oil, thick wedges of Parmesan and Asiago cheese. When he asks Maxine why these things are necessary, she explains that they are going to the middle of nowhere, that if they were to depend on the general store, they would have nothing to live on but potato chips and Wonder Bread and Pepsi. On the way to Massachusetts, he tells her things he figures she should know in advance, that they will not be able to touch or kiss each other in front of his parents, that there will be no wine with lunch. "There's plenty of wine in the trunk of the car," Maxine points out. "It doesn't matter," he tells her. "My parents don't own a corkscrew." The restrictions amuse her. She sees them as a single afternoon's challenge, an anomaly never to be repeated. She does not associate him with his parents' habits. She still cannot believe that she is to be the first girlfriend he's ever brought home. He feels no excitement over this prospect, wants simply to be done with it. Once they get off at his parents' exit, he senses that the landscape is foreign to her. The shopping plazas, the sprawling brick-faced public high school from which he and Sonia graduated, the shingled houses, uncomfortably close to one another on their grassy quarter-acre plots. The sign that says, "Children at Play." He knows that this sort of life, one which is such a proud accomplishment for his own parents, is of no relevance, no interest to her, that she loves him in spite of it. A van from a company that installs security systems blocks his parents' driveway, and so he parks on the street, by the mailbox on the edge of the lawn. He leads Maxine up the flagstone path, ringing the bell because his parents always keep the front door locked. His mother opens the door. He can tell she is nervous, dressed in one of her better saris, wearing lipstick and perfume, in contrast to the khakis and t-shirts and soft leather moccasins Goggle and Maxine both wear.
"Hi, Ma," he says, leaning over, giving his mother a quick kiss. "This is Maxine. Max, this is my mother, Ashima."
"It's so nice to finally meet you, Ashima," Maxine says, leaning over and giving his mother a kiss as well.
"These are for you," she says, handing Ashima a cellophane-wrapped basket full of tinned pâtés and jars of cornichons and chutneys that Goggle knows his parents will never open or enjoy. And yet, when Maxine had shopped for the things to put in the basket at Dean and DeLuca, he had said nothing to dissuade her. He walks in with his shoes on instead of changing into a pair of flip-flops that his parents keep in the hall closet. They follow his mother across the living room and around the corner into the kitchen. His mother returns to the stove, where she's deep-frying a batch of samosas, filling the air with a haze of smoke.
Nikhil's father is upstairs, his mother says to Maxine, lifting out a samosa with a slotted spatula and putting it on a paper towel-lined plate.
With the man from the alarm company. Sorry, lunch will be ready in a minute, she adds. I was not expecting you to arrive for another half an hour.
Why on earth are we getting a security system? Goggle wants to know.
It was your father's idea, his mother says, now that I would be on my own.
She says that there have been two burglaries recently in the neighborhood, both of them in the middle of the afternoon.
Even in good areas like this, these days, there are crimes, she says to Maxine, shaking her head.
His mother offers them glasses of frothy pink lassi, thick and sweet-tasting, flavored with rose water. They sit in the formal living room, where they normally never sit. Maxine sees the school pictures of Sonia and him in front of the blue-gray backgrounds arranged on the mantle of the brick fireplace, the family portraits from Olin Mills. She looks at his childhood photo albums with his mother. She admires the material of his mother's sari, mentioning that her mother creates textiles at the Met.
The Met?
The Metropolitan Museum of Art, Maxine explains.
You've been there, Ma, Goggle says. It's the big museum on Fifth Avenue.
With all the steps? I took you there to see the Egyptian temple, remember?
Yes, I remember. My father was an artist, she tells Maxine, pointing to one of his grandfather's watercolors on the wall.
They hear footsteps coming down the stairs, and then his father enters the living room, along with a uniformed man holding a clipboard. Unlike his mother, his father is not dressed up at all. He wears a pair of thin brown cotton pants, an untucked, slightly wrinkled short-sleeved shirt, and flip-flops. His gray hair looks more sparse than the last time Goggle remembers, his pot belly more pronounced.
Here's your copy of the receipt. Any problems, you just call the 800 number, the uniformed man says. He and his father shake hands.
Have a nice day, the man calls out before leaving.
Hi, Baba, Goggle says. I'd like you to meet Maxine.
Hello, his father says, putting up a hand, looking as if he is about to take an oath. He does not sit down with them. Instead, he asks Maxine,
That is your car outside?
It's a rental, she says.
Better to put it in the driveway, his father tells her.
It doesn't matter, Goggle says. It's fine where it is.
But better to be careful, his father persists. The neighborhood children, they're not very careful. One time, my car was on the road, and a baseball went through the window. I can park it for you if you like.
I'll do it, Goggle says, getting up, irritated by his parents' perpetual fear of disaster. When he returns to the house, the lunch is set out, too rich for the weather. Along with the samosas, there are breaded chicken cutlets, chickpeas with tamarind sauce, lamb biryani, chutney made with tomatoes from the garden. It is a meal he knows it has taken his mother over a day to prepare, and yet the amount of effort embarrasses him. The water glasses are already filled, plates and forks and paper napkins set on the dining room table they use only for special occasions, with uncomfortable high-back chairs and seats upholstered in gold velvet.
Go ahead and start, his mother says, still hovering between the dining room and the kitchen, finishing up the last of the samosas.
His parents are diffident around Maxine, at first keeping their distance, not boisterous as they typically are around their Bengali friends. They ask where she went to college, what it is her parents do, but Maxine is immune to their awkwardness, drawing them out, devoting her attention to them fully. And Goggle is reminded of the first time he'd met her, when she'd seduced him in the same way. She asks his father about his research project in Cleveland, his mother about her part-time job at the local public library, which she's recently begun. Goggle is only partly attentive to the conversation. He is overly aware that they are not used to passing things around the table, or to chewing food with their mouths fully closed. They avert their eyes when Maxine accidentally leans over to run her hand through his hair. To his relief, she eats generously, asking his mother how she made this and that, telling her it's the best Indian food she's ever tasted, accepting his mother's offer to pack them some extra cutlets and samosas for the road. When his mother confesses that she is nervous to be in the house alone, Maxine tells her she'd be nervous too. She mentions a break-in at her parents' once when she was by herself. When she tells them that she lives with her parents, Ashima says,
Really? I thought no one did that in America.
When she tells him she was born and raised in Manhattan, his father shakes his head.
New York is too much, he says. Too many cars, too many tall buildings.
He tells the story of the time they'd driven in for Goggle's graduation from Columbia. The trunk of the car broken into in just 5 minutes, their suitcase stolen, having to attend the commencement without a jacket and tie.
"It's a pity you can't stay for dinner," his mother says as the meal comes to an end. But his father urges him to get going.
"Better not to drive in the dark," he says.
Afterward, there is tea and bowls of payesh made in honor of his birthday. He receives a Hallmark card signed by both of his parents, a check for $100, a navy blue cotton sweater from Filene's.
"He'll need that where we're going," Maxine says approvingly. "The temperature can really drop at night."
In the driveway, there are hugs and kisses goodbye, initiated by Maxine, his parents reciprocating clumsily. His mother invites Maxine to please come again. He is given a piece of paper with his father's new phone number in Ohio and the date on which it will be activated.
"Have a good trip to Cleveland," he tells his father. "Good luck with the project."
"Okay," his father says. He packs Goggle on the shoulder. "I'll miss you," he says. In Bengali, he adds, "Remember to check in on your mother now and again."
"Don't worry, Baba. See you at Thanksgiving."
"Yes, see you," his father says, and then,
"Drive safely, Goggle."
At first, he's unaware of the slip, but as soon as they're in the car, buckling their seatbelts, Maxine says,
"What did your dad just call you?"
He shakes his head.
"It's nothing. I'll explain it later."
He turns on the ignition and begins to back out of the driveway away from his parents, who stand there waving until the last possible moment.
"Call to let us know you've arrived there safely,"
his mother says to Goggle in Bengali, but he waves and drives off, pretending not to hear. It's a relief to be back in her world, heading north across the state border. For a while it's nothing different, the same expanse of sky, the same strip of highway, large liquor stores and fast food chains on either side. Maxine knows the way, so there's no need to consult a map. He has been to New Hampshire once or twice with his family to see the leaves, driving for the day to places one could pull off the road and take pictures of and admire the view. But he's never been so far north. They pass farms, spotted cows grazing in fields, red silos, white wooden churches, barns with rusted tin roofs, small scattered towns. The names of the towns mean nothing to him. They leave the highway behind and drive on steep, slender, two-lane ribbons of road, the mountains appearing like enormous milky waves suspended against the sky. Wisps of cloud hang low over the summits, like smoke rising from the trees. Other clouds cast broad shadows across the valley. Eventually, there are only a few cars on the road, no signs for tourist facilities or campgrounds, just more farms and woods, the roadsides full of blue and purple flowers. He has no idea where he is or how far they've traveled. Maxine tells him they aren't far from Canada, that if they're motivated, they could drive into Montreal for the day. They turn down a long dirt road in the middle of a forest, dense with hemlock and birch. There is nothing to mark where they turned, no mailbox or sign. At first there is no house visible, nothing but large lime-colored ferns covering the ground. Small stones spray wildly under the tires, and the trees throw patterns of shade onto the hood of the car. They come to a partial clearing, to a humble house covered with bleached brown shingles and surrounded by a low wall of flat stones. Gerald and Lydia's Volvo is parked on the grass, because there is no driveway. Goggle and Maxine step out, and he's led by the hand to the back of the house, his limbs stiff from the hours in the car. Though the sun is beginning to set, its warmth is still palpable, the air lazy and mild. As they approach, he sees that after a certain expanse, the yard falls away, and then he sees the lake, a blue, a thousand times deeper, more brilliant than the sky, and girded by pines. The mountains rise up behind them. The lake is bigger than he'd expected, a distance he cannot imagine swimming across.
"We're here,"
Maxine calls out, waving, her arms in a V. They walk toward her parents, who are sitting on Adirondack chairs on the grass, their legs and feet bare, drinking cocktails and admiring the view. Silas comes bounding toward them, barking across the lawn. Gerald and Lydia are tanner, leaner, a bit scantily dressed, Lydia in a white tank top and denim wrap skirt, Gerald in wrinkled blue shorts, a green polo shirt faded with use. Lydia's arms are nearly as dark as his own. Gerald has burned. Discarded books lie at their feet, face down on the grass.
A turquoise dragonfly hovers above them, then darts crookedly away. They turn their heads in greeting, shielding their eyes from the sun's glare.
"Welcome to paradise," Gerald says.
It is the opposite of how they live in New York. The house is dark, a bit musty, full of primitive, mismatched furniture. There are exposed pipes in the bathrooms, wires stapled over door sills, nails protruding from beams. On the walls are clusters of local butterflies, mounted and framed, a map of the region on thin white paper, photographs of the family at the lake over the years. Checkered cotton curtains hang in the windows on thin white rods. Instead of staying with Gerald and Lydia, he and Maxine sleep in an unheated cabin down the path from the main house. No bigger than a cell, the space was originally built for Maxine to play in when she was a girl. There's a small chest of drawers, a crude night table between two twin beds, a lamp with a plaid paper shade, two wooden chests in which extra quilts are stored. The beds are covered with ancient electric blankets. In the corner is a device whose hum is supposed to keep the bats away. Hairy, unfinished logs hold up the roof, and there is a gap between where the floor ends and the wall begins, so that one can see a thin line of grass. There are insect carcasses everywhere, squashed against the window panes and walls, languishing in pools of water behind the taps of the sink. It's sort of like being at camp, Maxine says as they unpack their things. But Goggle has never been to camp, and though he is only 3 hours away from his parents' house, this is an unknown world to him, a kind of holiday he's never been on. During the days, he sits with Maxine's family on a thin strip of beach, looking out onto the glittering jade lake, surrounded by other homes, overturned canoes. Long docks jut into the water, tadpoles dart close to the shore. He does as they do, sitting on a folding chair, a cotton cap on his head, applying sunblock at intervals to his arms, reading, falling asleep after barely a page. He wades into the water and swims to the dock when his shoulders grow too warm, the sand free of stones or growth, smooth and yielding under his feet. Occasionally, they are joined by Maxine's grandparents, Hank and Edith, who live on the lake several houses away. Hank, a retired professor of classical archaeology, always brings a small volume of Greek poetry to read, his long, sun-spotted fingers curling over the tops of the pages. At some point he gets up, laboriously removing his shoes and socks, and walks calf-deep into the water, regarding the surroundings with his hands on his hips, his chin thrust pridefully into the air. Edith is small and thin, proportioned like a girl, her white hair cut in a bob and her face deeply wrinkled. They have traveled a bit of the world together, Italy, Greece, Egypt, Iran. "We never got as far as India," Edith tells him. "We would certainly have loved to have seen that." All day he and Maxine walk about the property barefoot in their bathing suits. Goggle goes for runs around the lake with Gerald, arduous laps along steep hilly dirt roads, so infrequently traveled that they can occupy the dead center. Halfway around is a small private graveyard where members of the Ratliff family lie buried, where Gerald and Goggle always stop to catch their breath, where Maxine will be buried one day. Gerald spends most of his time in his vegetable garden, his nails permanently blackened from his careful cultivation of lettuce and herbs. One day, Goggle and Maxine swim over to Hank and Edith's for lunch, for egg salad sandwiches and canned tomato soup. Some nights, when it's too warm in the cabin, he and Maxine take a flashlight and walk to the lake in their pajamas to go skinny dipping. They swim in the dark water, under the moonlight, weeds catching their limbs, out to the neighboring dock. The unfamiliar sensation of water surrounding his unclothed body arouses Goggle, and when they come back to the shore they make love on the grass that is wet from their bodies. He looks up at her, and behind her, at the sky, which holds more stars than he has ever seen at one time, crowded together, a mess of dust and gems. In spite of the fact there is nothing in particular to do, the days assume a pattern. There's a certain stringency to life, a willful doing without. In the mornings they wake early to the frenzied chirping of birds, when the eastern sky is streaked with the thinnest of pink clouds. Breakfast is eaten by 7, on the screened-in porch overlooking the lake, where they have all their meals. Homemade preserves slathered on thick slices of bread. Their news of the world comes from the thin local paper Gerald brings back each day from the general store. In the late afternoons, they shower and dress for dinner. They sit with their drinks on the lawn, eating pieces of cheese Goggle and Maxine brought from New York, and watch the sunset behind the mountains, bats darting between the pines that soar as tall as 10-story buildings, all the bathing suits hung to dry on a line. Dinners are simple. Boiled corn from a farm stand, cold chicken, pasta with pesto, tomatoes from the garden, sliced and salted on a plate. Lydia bakes pies and cobblers with berries picked by hand. Occasionally, she disappears for the day to go antiquing in the surrounding towns. There's no television to watch in the evenings, just an old stereo in which they sometimes play a symphony or jazz. On the first rainy day, Gerald and Lydia teach him to play cribbage. They are often in bed by 9. The phone, in the main house, seldom rings. He grows to appreciate being utterly disconnected from the world. He grows used to the quiet, the scent of sun-warmed wood. The only sounds are the occasional motorboat cutting across the water, screen doors snapping shut. He presents Gerald and Lydia with a sketch of the main house done one afternoon down at the beach, the first thing he's drawn in years that hasn't been for work. They set it atop the crowded mantel of the stone fireplace, next to piles of books and photographs, promise to have it framed. The family seems to possess every piece of the landscape, not only the house itself, but every tree and blade of grass. Nothing is locked, not the main house or the cabin that he and Maxine sleep in. Anyone could walk in. He thinks of the alarm system now installed in his parents' house, wonders why they cannot relax about their physical surroundings in the same way. The Ratliffs own the moon that floats over the lake, and the sun and the clouds. It is a place that has been good to them, as much a part of them as a member of the family. The idea of returning year after year to a single place appeals to Goggle deeply. Yet he cannot picture his family occupying a house like this, playing board games on rainy afternoons, watching shooting stars at night, all their relatives gathered neatly on a small strip of sand. It is an impulse his parents have never felt, this need to be so far from things. They would have felt lonely in this setting, remarking that they were the only Indians. They would not want to go hiking, as he and Maxine and Gerald and Lydia do almost every day, up the Rocky Mountain trails to watch the sunset over the valley. They would not care to cook with the fresh basil that grows rampant in Gerald's garden, or to spend a whole day boiling blueberries for jam. His mother would not put on a bathing suit or swim. He feels no nostalgia for the vacations he spent with his family, and he realizes now that they were never really true vacations at all. Instead, they were overwhelming, disorienting expeditions, either going to Calcutta or sightseeing in places they did not belong to and intended never to see again. Some summers there had been road trips with one or two Bengali families, in rented vans going to Toronto or Atlanta or Chicago, places where they had other Bengali friends. The fathers would be huddled at the front, taking turns at the wheel, consulting maps highlighted by AAA. All the children would sit in the back with plastic tubs of aloo dum and cold, flattened luchis wrapped in foil, fried the day before, which they would stop in state parks to eat on picnic tables. They had stayed in motels, slept whole families to a single room, swum in pools that could be seen from the road. One day they canoe across the lake. Maxine teaches him how to paddle properly, angling the oar and drawing it back through the still gray water. She speaks reverently of her summers here. This is her favorite place in the world, she tells him, and he understands that this landscape, the water of this particular lake in which she first learned to swim, is an essential part of her, even more so than the house in Chelsea. This was where she lost her virginity, she confesses, when she was 14 years old, in a boathouse, with a boy whose family once summered here. He thinks of himself at 14, his life nothing like it is now, still called Goggle and nothing else. He remembers Maxine's reaction to his telling her about his other name, as they'd driven up from his parents' house. That's the cutest thing I've ever heard, she'd said. And then she'd never mentioned it again. This essential fact about his life slipping from her mind as so many others did. He realizes that this is a place that will always be here for her. It makes it easy to imagine her past and her future, to picture her growing old.
He sees her with streaks of gray in her hair, her face still beautiful, her long body slightly widened and slack, sitting on a beach chair with a floppy hat on her head. He sees her returning here, grieving, to bury her parents, teaching her children to swim in the lake, leading them with two hands into the water, showing them how to dive cleanly off the edge of the dock. It is here that his 27th birthday is celebrated, the first birthday in his life that he hasn't spent with his own parents, either in Calcutta or on Pemberton Road. Lydia and Maxine plan a special dinner, curling up with cookbooks for days beforehand on the beach. They decide to make a paella, drive to Maine for the mussels and clams. An angel food cake is baked from scratch. They bring the dining table out onto the lawn, a few card tables added on to make room for everyone. In addition to Hank and Edith, a number of friends from around the lake are invited. The women arrive in straw hats and linen dresses. The front lawn fills up with cars and small children scamper among them. There is talk of the lake, the temperature dropping, the water turning cooler, summer coming to an end. There are complaints about motorboats, gossip about the owner of the general store, whose wife has run off with another man and is seeking a divorce. "Here's the architect Max brought up with her," Gerald says at one point, leading him over to a couple interested in building an addition to their cottage. Goggle speaks to the couple about their plans, promises to come down and have a look at their place before he leaves. At dinner, he is asked by his neighbor, a middle-aged woman named Pamela, at what age he moved to America from India. "I'm from Boston," he says. It turns out Pamela is from Boston as well, but when he tells her the name of the suburb where his parents live, Pamela shakes her head. "I've never heard of that," she goes on. "I once had a girlfriend who went to India." "Oh, where did she go?" "I don't know. All I remember is that she came back thin as a rail, and I was horribly envious of her," Pamela laughs. "But you must be lucky that way." "What do you mean?" "I mean, you must never get sick." "Actually, that's not true," he says, slightly annoyed. He looks over at Maxine, trying to catch her eye, but she's speaking intently with her neighbor. "We get sick all the time. We have to get shots before we go. My parents devote the better part of a suitcase to medicine." "But you're Indian," Pamela says, frowning. "I'd think the climate wouldn't affect you, given your heritage." "Pamela, Nick's American," Lydia says, leaning across the table, rescuing Goggle from the conversation. "He was born here." She turns to him, and he sees from Lydia's expression that after all these months, she herself isn't sure. "Weren't you?" Champagne is poured with the cake. "To Nikhil," Gerald announces, raising his glass. "Everybody sings happy birthday. This group has known him only for one evening. Who will forget him the next day?" It is in the midst of the laughter of these drunken adults and the cries of their children running barefoot, chasing fireflies on the lawn, that he remembers that his father left for Cleveland a week ago, that by now he's there, in a new apartment, alone. That his mother is alone on Pemberton Road. He knows he should call to make sure his father has arrived safely, and to find out how his mother is faring on her own. But such concerns make no sense here among Maxine and her family. That night, lying in the cabin beside Maxine, he is woken by the sound of the phone ringing persistently in the main house. He gets out of bed, convinced that it's his parents calling to wish him a happy birthday, mortified that it will wake Gerald and Lydia from sleep. He stumbles onto the lawn, but when his bare feet strike the cold grass, there is silence, and he realizes the ringing he'd heard had been a dream. He returns to bed, squeezing in beside Maxine's warm, sleeping body, and drapes his arm around her narrow waist, fits his knees behind hers. Through the window he sees that dawn is creeping into the sky, only a handful of stars still visible, the shapes of the surrounding pines and cabins growing distinct. A bird begins to call. And then he remembers that his parents can't possibly reach him. He has not given them the number, and the Ratliffs are enlisted. That here, at Maxine's side, in this cloistered wilderness, he is free. Chapter 7 Ashima sits at the kitchen table on Pemberton Road, addressing Christmas cards. A cup of Lipton tea grows slowly cold by her hand. Three different address books are open before her, along with some calligraphy pens she's found in the dress drawer in Goggle's room, and the stack of cards and a bit of dampened sponge to seal the envelopes with. The oldest of the address books, bought 28 years ago at a stationery store in Harvard Square, has a pebbly black cover and blue pages, bound together by a rubber band. The other two are larger, prettier, the alphabetical tabs still intact. One has a padded dark green cover and pages edged in gilt. Her favorite, a birthday gift from Goggle, features paintings that hang in the Museum of Modern Art. On the end papers of these books are phone numbers corresponding to no one, and the 800 numbers of all the airlines they've flown back and forth to Calcutta, and reservation numbers, and her ballpoint doodles as she was kept on hold. Having three separate address books makes her current task a bit complicated, but Ashima does not believe in crossing out names or consolidating them into a single book. She prides herself on each entry in each volume, for together they form a record of all the Bengalis she and Ashok have known over the years, all the people she has had the fortune to share rice with in a foreign land. She remembers the day she bought the oldest book, soon after arriving in America, one of her first trips out of the apartment without Ashok at her side, the $5 bill in her purse feeling like a fortune. She remembers selecting the smallest and cheapest style, saying, "I would like to buy this one, please," as she placed the item on the counter, her heart pounding for fear that she would not be understood. The salesperson had not even glanced at her, had said nothing other than the price. She had come back to the apartment and written into the book's blank blue pages her parents' address in Calcutta on Amherst Street, and then her in-laws in Alipur, and finally her own, the apartment in Central Square, so that she would remember it. She had written in Ashok's extension at MIT, conscious of writing his name for the first time in her life, writing his last name as well. That had been her world. She has made her own Christmas cards this year, an idea she picked up from a book in the crafts section of the library. Normally, she buys boxes of cards, marked 50% off at department stores in January, always forgetting, by the following winter, exactly where in the house she's put them. She is careful to choose ones that say, "Happy Holidays" or "Season's Greetings," as opposed to "Merry Christmas," to avoid angels or nativity scenes in favor of what she considers firmly secular images, a sleigh being pulled through a snow-covered field, or skaters on a pond. This year's card is a drawing she has done herself, of an elephant decked with red and green jewels glued onto silver paper. The elephant is a replica of a drawing her father had done for Goggle over 27 years ago, in the margins of an aerogram. She has saved her dead parents' letters on the top shelf of her closet, in a large white purse she used to carry in the 70s until the strap broke. Once a year, she dumps the letters onto her bed and goes through them, devoting an entire day to her parents' words, allowing herself a good cry. She revisits their affection and concern, conveyed weekly, faithfully across continents, all the bits of news that had nothing to do with her life in Cambridge, but which had sustained her in those days nevertheless. Her ability to reproduce the elephant has surprised her. She has not drawn a thing since she was a child, has assumed she'd long forgotten what her father had once taught her, and what her son has inherited, about holding the pen with confidence and making bold, swift strokes. She's spent a whole day redoing the drawing on different sheets of paper, coloring it in, trimming it to size, taking it to the university copy center. For an entire evening, she had driven herself to different stationery stores in the town, looking for red envelopes that the cards would fit into. She has time to do things like this now that she is alone, now that there is no one to feed or entertain or talk to for weeks at a time. At 48, she has come to experience the solitude that her husband and son and daughter already know, and which they claim not to mind. "It is not such a big deal," her children tell her. "Everyone should live on their own at some point." But Ashima feels too old to learn such a skill. She hates returning in the evenings to a dark, empty house, going to sleep on one side of the bed and waking up on another. At first, she was wildly industrious, cleaning out closets and scrubbing the insides of kitchen cupboards and scraping the shelves of the refrigerator, rinsing out the vegetable bins. In spite of the security system, she would sit up startled in the middle of the night by a sound somewhere in the house, or the rapid taps that traveled through the baseboards when heat flowed through the pipes. For nights on end, she would double-check all the window locks, making sure that they were fastened tightly. There was the night she'd been roused by a repetitive banging outside the front door and called Ashok in Ohio. With a cordless phone pressed to her ear, she'd gone downstairs and looked through the peephole, and when she'd finally opened the door, she saw that it was only the screen door, which she'd forgotten to latch, swinging wildly in the wind. Now she does laundry once a month. She no longer dusts, or notices dust, for that matter. She eats on the sofa, in front of the television, simple meals of buttered toast and dal, a single pot lasting her a week, and an omelette to go with it if she has the energy to bother. Sometimes she eats the way Gogol and Sonia do when they visit, standing in front of the refrigerator, not bothering to heat up the food in the oven or to put it on a plate. Her hair is thinning, graying, still parted in the middle, worn in a bun instead of a braid. She's been fitted for bifocals recently, and they hang against the folds of her sari on a chain around her neck. 3 afternoons a week and 2 Saturdays a month, she works at the public library, just as Sonia had done when she was in high school. It is Ashima's first job in America, the first since before she was married. She signs her small paychecks over to Ashok, and he deposits them for her at the bank into their account. She works at the library to pass the time. She has been going regularly for years, taking her children to story hour when they were young, and checking out magazines and books of knitting patterns for herself. And one day Mrs. Buxton, the head librarian, asked if she would be interested in a part-time position. At first, her responsibilities were the same as those of high school girls, shelving the books that people returned, making sure that sections of shelves were in precise alphabetical order, sometimes running a feather duster along the spines. She mended old books, put protective covers on new arrivals, organized monthly displays on subjects such as gardening, presidential biographies, poetry, African-American history. Lately, she's begun to work at the main desk, greeting regular patrons by name as they walk through the doors, filling out forms for interlibrary loans. She's friendly with other women who work at the library, most of them also with grown children. A number of them live alone, as Ashima does now, because they are divorced. They are the first American friends she has made in her life. Over tea in the staff room, they gossip about the patrons, about the perils of dating in middle age. On occasion, she has her library friends over to the house for lunch, goes shopping with them on weekends to outlet stores in Maine. Every 3 weekends, her husband comes home. He arrives by taxi. Though she is willing to drive herself around their town, she is not willing to get on the highway and drive to Logan. When her husband is in the house, she shops and cooks as she used to. If there is a dinner invitation at friends, they go together, driving along the highway without the children, sadly aware that Gogol and Sonia, now both grown, will never sit with them in the back seat again. During his visits, Ashok keeps his clothes in his suitcase, his shaving things in a bag by the sink. He does the things she still doesn't know how to do. He pays all the bills and rakes the leaves on the lawn and puts gas from the self-service station into her car. His visits are too short to make a difference, and within hours, it seems, Sunday comes, and she is on her own again. When they are apart, they speak by phone every night at 8 o'clock. Sometimes, not knowing what to do with herself after dinner, she is already in bed by then, in her nightgown, watching the small black-and-white television they've owned for decades that lives on her side of the bed, the picture gradually disappearing, a rim of black perpetually framing the screen. If there is nothing decent on television, she leafs through books she takes out of the library, books that occupy the space Ashok normally does on the bed. Now it is 3 in the afternoon, the sun's strength already draining from the sky. It is a sort of day that seems to end minutes after it begins. Defeating Ashima's intentions to spend it fruitfully, the inevitability of nightfall distracting her. The sort of day when Ashima craves her dinner by 5. It's one of the things she's always hated about her life here, these chilly, abbreviated days of early winter, darkness descending mere hours after noon. She expects nothing of days such as this, simply waits for them to end. She is resigned to warming dinner for herself in a little while, changing into her nightgown, switching on the electric blanket on her bed. She takes a sip of her tea, now stone cold. She gets up to refill the kettle, make another cup. The petunias in her window box, planted Memorial Day weekend, the last time Gogol and Sonia were home together, have withered to shuddering brown stalks that she's been meaning for weeks to root from the soil. Ashok will do it, she thinks to herself, and when the phone rings and her husband says hello, this is the first thing she tells him. She hears noises in the background, people speaking. Are you watching television? She asks him. I'm in the hospital, he tells her. What's happened?
She turns off the whistling kettle, startled, her chest